Welcome to Indie Week on your North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. As with all of our casts, it's included for blind and print-impaired audience. Reading this issue, dated Wednesday, December 19th, I am John Federson. And this week's issue of Indie Week is a bit off the beaten path for them. They say themselves they have decided to write little featurettes, articles about 19 people in the Triangle this year that changed the Triangle in various ways, for good and sometimes questionably. And so there's so many articles that we probably won't get to all of them today, but we'll sure do our best without actually reading so fast as to spin your head around. And here we go. Mary Ann Baldwin, written by Lee Towse. The wave was coming, but even Mary Ann Baldwin didn't see how strong it was. She thought, or at least hoped, that she'd edge out former Wake County Commissioner Carolyn Sullivan and survive the first round of voting in October. After all, she'd won the endorsements of both the Indy and the News and Observer, which she'd never expected. The question was by how much she'd trail Attorney Charles Francis, who'd run for mayor in 2017 and lost to Nancy McFarlane. If the margin was a few points, she could probably catch up. If he was close to 50%, it might not be worth a runoff. But the ground had shifted in Raleigh. As the returns came in, it became apparent that voters had turned on the anti-development city council they'd elected 2 years earlier. They were done with the infighting and toxicity, done with endless arguments about picayune details. They wanted Raleigh to build its future, not fight the battles of its past. Steph Mendel got wiped out in District E. Kay Crowder was behind in District D. Russ Stevenson was losing his at-large race. David Cox was neck and neck in District B. He would ultimately prevail. And Mary Ann Baldwin, the outspoken former city council member, wasn't clinging to second. She was out front, 38-31. Unlike 2 years ago, Francis didn't bother calling for a runoff. He could see the writing on the wall. The notorious MAB was not only ahead, but she was also likely to take the lion's share of Sullivan's 21%. It was over. Baldwin had stayed on the sidelines since leaving the council in 2017, scolding her colleagues on her way out for keeping a plan to legalize accessory dwelling units in a committee. It would linger there another year. In her absence, the council's new majority focused on protecting neighborhoods. It saw growth as a threat and fought bitterly over rezoning cases and newfangled things like electric scooters and short-term rentals. Baldwin watched, chiming in with her dissent on Twitter. It didn't go unnoticed. In June 2018, the council's majority abruptly removed Baldwin from the Go Triangle Board of Trustees. No one talked to her about it first. One morning, 9 months later, Baldwin, prone to insomnia, though she slept well that night, awoke to her phone buzzing with news. McFarlane had just announced she wouldn't seek a fifth term. Baldwin doesn't remember the first person to call her, but they all had the same question. Was she running? Baldwin was instinctively drawn to the race, but until the last second, she had her doubts. She was set to announce her candidacy on Wednesday, March 27th. She recorded an interview with the Indy the previous Friday, making her announcement, but only with the caveat that she might change her mind over the weekend, maybe even on Monday. She didn't. McFarlane endorsed Sullivan, whom she'd recruited. Sullivan, who had little name recognition but access to a lot of money, pledged to build consensus between the anti- and pro-growth camps. Baldwin, pugnacious and unapologetic in her vision of Raleigh as a big city rather than a small town, was ready to bulldoze the NIMBYs, who, in turn, cast their lots with Francis. Then there were the council races, which took on similar contours with aggressive, often millennial, pro-development candidates putting the anti-development incumbents on their heels. Their views tended to align with Baldwin's. They wanted Raleigh to become a dense, walkable city, a place to live, work, and play, with a downtown that could accommodate all three, and promised to go big on affordable housing to protect vulnerable residents amid unavoidable growth. The incumbents, on the other hand, tried to make the airport authority's decision to lease property to a quarry company the election's central issue. That didn't work. On December 2nd, Baldwin became the third woman to hold the title of Raleigh mayor. And she took office with almost exactly the council she wanted. Young, like-minded, energetic, ready to get things done. Its first meeting was a blaze of activity, a rush to correct what it saw as its predecessor's missteps on ADUs and short-term rentals, among other issues. But Baldwin knows that's the low-hanging fruit. On the more difficult stuff, the onus is on her to deliver. We are willing now to move forward on some big ideas, Baldwin says. We need to lead on big issues like housing affordability, and I'm hoping that our residents are with us and that they support us to do these big things. What that will mean is an ambitious housing bond on the 2020 ballot, perhaps something akin to what Durham passed last month. Of course, the devil's in the details, and the fine print has yet to be determined. More recent discussions have included the feasibility of universal free bus service, which Kansas City recently passed. Baldwin's colleagues are champing at the bit. Her biggest challenge, she says, might just be reining them in. They're going to want to do everything all at once, and we can't do everything all at once, she says. It has got to be at the right place. Pardon me, that last quote. It has got to be at the right pace. All right, in our second article, Steve Shule, who I believe started the Independent Weekly, the newspaper, in 1983. The Durham mayor pushed through the biggest housing bond in North Carolina history. Now comes the hard part. This is by Jeffrey Billman. In February, in an expansive State of the City address, Durham Mayor Steve Shule laid out an ambitious, wide-ranging vision for a prosperous city, touching on criminal justice reform, immigrant rights, and light rail, which ignominiously died soon thereafter, among other things. But the highlight of the speech and the biggest news of the night was Shule's proposal for a $95 million bond to fund the city's affordable housing plans. It passed. If passed, it would be the largest housing board in North Carolina history by far. And, though Shule didn't say it, it would also be his legacy project, the thing that would define his tenure in office for better or worse. If we do the affordable housing work we are doing now, funded at the same level, we will not significantly alter the future of downtown as the province of upper-middle-class white people, while people of color are pushed to the margins, farther and farther from good jobs and the public transit to get them to those jobs, said Shule, who did found and first published what was then called the Independent Weekly in 1983. The bond, he continued, would fill a funding gap in the city's five-year housing plan and build and preserve more than 2,500 affordable units, move at least 1,700 homeless households into permanent housing, create at least 190 home ownership opportunities for low-income households, and help the Durham Housing Authority, which had recently announced plans for 2,500 new affordable and market-rate units, redevelop its downtown properties. This was part of a multi-pronged attack on the gentrification and displacement that have eaten away at working-class communities as newcomers poured in. Another piece was expanded housing choices, an effort to boost the housing supply by increasing density in single-family neighborhoods near downtown. The bond went on the November ballot, but no one knew what to expect. There was no polling, not by candidates or interest groups or news organizations. Durham is a reliable liberal city, but the bond still required a tax increase. More important, it required the city's voters, many of whom remembered the destruction of Hy-T and the broken promises of urban renewal, to trust their government. Shule, a worrier by nature, wasn't concerned about his own re-election, but he was nervous about the bond. He thought it would probably pass, maybe with 55%. Not a lot of wiggle room, but there was no way to be sure. At community forums, the loudest voices were vociferously against it, accusing city leaders of renovating outdated public housing as a pretense for moving poor people out and making way for more shiny condos. They could promise that this wasn't the case, that federal law didn't allow them to do that even if they wanted to, but who knew if that message was getting through? So Shule spent the fall on the stump, meeting with anyone who would listen. This was the city's defining issue, he told them. The bond was the only thing that would keep Durham from turning into a Disney version of itself, a playground for rich white people, its black heritage slowly erased, communities of color pushed to the hinterlands. Council member Charlie Reese was more confident. He told the mayor that the bond would get upward of 80% of the vote. As it turns out, he was very nearly right. On November 5th, 76% of the 34,000 Durham voters who came to the polls backed the measure. The bond had majority support in all of the county's precincts. It was a resounding show of support, which Shewell says he found so gratifying. And now things will get more difficult. For city officials, the hardest part will be managing the logistics, which are legion. There are construction bids to solicit an implementation oversight committee to appoint individual projects to evaluate and vote on, nonprofit partners to work with, municipal bonds to purchase, and bit by bit, taxes to raise. It won't all happen at once. It will take time to secure the bonds and get the money out of the door, and more time for construction to get underway, and at each step there's the potential for something to go sideways, money to be misspent, a project to go over budget or be delayed even, perhaps for a scandal to emerge. Durham has generally been viewed as a well-managed city, but it takes only one misstep for perceptions to change, and much remains outside the city's control. The timing and ultimate price tag of DHA renovations, for instance, depend on fickle state tax credits. With this many moving parts, Shewell acknowledges there are going to be bumps in the road. For Shewell, however, the biggest challenge might be managing expectations. The bond won't change state laws that prevent the city from requiring developers to include affordable housing in their projects or controlling rents, nor will it halt market forces. It won't stop people from moving to Durham, looking for housing downtown, driving up housing costs, and causing displacement and gentrification. If the bond succeeds, it will mitigate those things. Politically, of course, that sort of counterfactual can make for a difficult argument. Even in a progressive city, pardon me, even in a progressive city, people tend to be skeptical that the government is spending their money well. We can't stop the bleeding, but we can put a tourniquet on it, Shewell says. The market forces are what they are. Displacement will continue, but we can make a big difference. The city will also have to contend with African-American residents, afraid of the city's intentions, and that a sordid history might repeat itself. The trust issue is so powerful, Shewell says. There's just very significant distrust in the black community of anything that seems like urban renewal. We have to do it differently. We have to do it right. We have to prove it. In February, Shewell will give another State of the City address detailing how the city will proceed and asking residents for their trust and patience. This won't be easy, he'll say. It won't happen overnight. But Shewell believes Durham has the opportunity to do something special, to begin to wrap its arms around a seemingly untenable problem that cities all over the country haven't been able to figure out. Talman Trask III by Jeffrey C. Billman. Talman Trask III made for a convenient villain. His name smacks of the sort of wealth and privilege you can't help but imagine inhabiting Duke University's C-suite. Then there's the scandal that made that name infamous, that time in 2014 that Trask allegedly struck a parking attendant with his Porsche, of course, and then called her a dumb, stupid N-word. So when negotiations between Duke and Go Triangle collapsed over light rail's route and Duke bailed on the project at the end of February, dooming a plan 2 decades and $158 million in the making, Trask and the other top Duke officials bore the brunt of Durham's ire. Trask, Duke's point person on the negotiations, had been the guy, according to a timeline that Go Triangle supplied to the media, who suggested moving the line away from Duke's medical facilities on Irwin Road and closer to a black neighborhood. When that didn't happen, Duke refused to sign the cooperative agreement that Go Triangle needed to move ahead. As one local official bitterly told the Indy, they didn't want the inconvenience. But the story isn't quite that simple. No doubt, Duke played dirty pool. It was hardly a secret light rail was coming down Irwin Road. In fact, according to Go Triangle, Trask asked Go Triangle to put a station on Irwin in 2015 to reinforce the campus gateway, and the route was set by 2016. And while Duke had legitimate concerns, mainly about light rail interfering with medical equipment, the university didn't raise them until 2017. The increasingly desperate Go Triangle would have done anything to accommodate those concerns. There were plausible, if difficult, workarounds, but Duke was content to string things along. Put simply, Duke didn't want to be bothered by light rail, but it also wanted to avoid sticking in the knife, hoping instead the problem would resolve itself. Eventually, though, it saw no other choice. There were lots of fingerprints on the murder weapon, however. Begin with the General Assembly, never a fan of mass transit. It drew first blood in 2018 when it opposed an arbitrary deadline on the project that forced Go Triangle to press the pedal to the metal or forego state funding. The Durham Orange Light Rail Transit Project also had self-inflicted wounds. Go Triangle hadn't raised the money it needed or reached agreements with the railroad companies that controlled the tracks it planned to use. Both of those could have been deal killers by themselves. By early 2019, you could have made the argument that light rail was asking to be put out of its misery. After all, it was forging ahead, knowing that Duke University or the railroads could kill the project on a whim. Who thought that was a good idea? After light rail's demise, Go Triangle commissioned a post-mortem from the American Public Transportation Association. Its report drove home that point. Agencies should be very cautious before undertaking costly work in advance of specific and enforceable commitments from key stakeholders, or at a minimum, without conscious and defined assessments regarding the state of stakeholder consensus, the report says. Here, Go Triangle believed that the railroads and Duke University were in fact fully committed to advancing the DOLRT and resolving key engineering issues. As demonstrated here, advancing work on the basis of broad promises and commitments in the hope of future specificity and enforceable agreements is risky and substantially enhances the negotiating position of the stakeholder. Another takeaway from the APTA report was that no one really thought Go Triangle was capable of pulling off a project as big and complex as light rail. That allowed Duke, the railroads, and other business interests to defer, delay, and disengage. They figured the whole enterprise was destined to fail anyway, while Go Triangle officials engaged in wishful thinking. Hope and optimism tended to trump frustration and concern. Many were willing to move forward on the assumption that the organization could successfully deliver the project, even as they questioned whether it really would. With light rail's failure in the rearview, a few reality checks. One, as the APTA report highlights, a $3.3 billion, 17.7-mile light rail line from Durham to Chapel Hill was probably beyond Go Triangle's capacity and might not have been the most efficient use of transit funds in the first place. Two, the DOLRT was likely dead the second the legislature imposed what was, in retrospect, an impossible deadline. And three, yes, Duke screwed us. But in a perverse way, maybe it saved us from ourselves, albeit in the most elitist way possible. Of course, try telling that to the folks who worked for nearly 20 years to make light rail a reality, only to see it all vanish because, well, Duke had a veto and felt like using it. In October, Duke announced that Trask will retire next year, following a quarter century at the university. A press release touted his contributions to the revitalization of downtown Durham, including the resuscitation of the American Tobacco Campus, championing the Durham Performing Arts Center, and moving some 3,000 Duke employees into the city's core. Talman will rightfully be remembered at Duke for his steady transformation of our campus, said Duke President Vincent Price. Maybe that's how he'll be remembered at Duke. But that's probably not how he'll be remembered in Durham. Lee Toss also wrote about Deb Butler. Deb Butler knew something was amiss the second she took her seat on the House floor. The day before, Democratic leaders had informed their caucus not to expect to vote that morning, September 11. The Wilmington Representatives' side of the room was nearly empty. Governor Cooper was scheduled to be at a remembrance ceremony, and many of her colleagues were busy preparing for other meetings, but nearly every Republican seat was full. A lump formed in her throat. It had already been a hellish year for Butler, who had suddenly lost her wife, Annie Parra, to an aneurysm 3 days after Christmas. After getting a call at work, Butler sped to the hospital, where doctors informed her that Parra had no hope of any quality of life. A few years ago, life and death decisions would have been left to Parra's parents or siblings. But because of a 2014 Supreme Court ruling in North Carolina overturning the state's ban on gay marriage, the burden fell to Butler. "It made me keenly aware that what I do as a lawmaker matters," she says. She was only the second openly LGBTQ member of the General Assembly when she was appointed in 2017. She entered the arena facing a Republican supermajority that had rammed through HB2 and stripped Governor Cooper of his power before he'd even taken office. But GOP's grip had loosened in 2018, when Democrats won enough seats to break the supermajority and give Cooper a veto, which he had used in budget negotiations. He wanted to force Republicans to come to an agreement on Medicaid expansion, along with higher teacher raises. Republicans wanted nothing to do with it, especially Medicaid. There was gridlock. The long, hot summer dragged on without a resolution. Republicans blamed the governor for holding teachers' pay hostage over Medicaid. The governor blamed Republicans for holding teachers' pay and poor people's health care hostage over corporate tax cuts. There was no end in sight. And then the Republicans played dirty. Or at least that's the Democrats' version. The Republicans don't see it that way. By their lights, they merely exploited the rules of the game. It's not their fault the Dems let their guard down and took them at their word. What kind of sucker would do that? Either way, here's what went down. On September 10th, GOP leaders informed the Democratic caucus not to expect any meaningful votes the next morning. At 8:30 a.m., House Speaker Tim Moore called the session to order. Then, just minutes before the 18th anniversary of when the first plane struck the North Tower, he began to call the motion to override the governor's budget veto. Of the House 120 members, only 64 were present. Of them, only 9 were Democrats. Republicans had the supermajority they needed. At first, Butler was terrified. Then she was furious. She stood. A microphone was in her hand. She started to yell. "You shall not do this to democracy in North Carolina, Mr. Speaker," she shouted. A police officer stepped closer to her as Moore instructed her to yield the floor. "I will not yield. I will not yield, Mr. Speaker. You shall not usurp the process, Mr. Speaker. How dare you subject this body to trickery, deceptive practices, hijacking the process? We have been here day and night for months defending what we believe." Her male colleagues formed a human shield around her, and she continued to cry out, "It is so typical of the way you conduct yourselves. How dare you do this, Mr. Speaker?" Her plea fell on deaf ears. The House quickly voted to overturn Cooper's vetoes. There were no news crews there that morning, but a colleague captured the scene on the camera phone. The video went viral, resonating on a national stage. One woman standing up to injustice, one powerful voice, even in a moment of futility, trying to make a difference. And when the odds are hopeless, you keep fighting. After Butler lost her wife, she ended up in the hospital with a back injury. All of the world's unluckiness was crashing down upon her. But she remembers one constituent who had also lost her spouse, offering this. "You know, Deb, there's just no way through this, but through it." "I don't know why," Butler says, "but it made me remember to just keep putting one foot in front of the other." Republicans won that battle, but they didn't win the war. The state and national media pilloried the GOP's tactics, and with Democrats on full alert, Republicans in the Senate were unable to muster enough votes to override the veto before the General Assembly adjourned for the year. Instead, the legislature passed a handful of mini-budgets, while Republicans and Cooper failed to come to terms on Medicaid and teacher pay. Long before Representative Butler stood up against the assault on our democracy on 9/11, she had already made a name for herself as a spark plug for progress, Governor Cooper told the Indy. When she spoke out on the floor that day, she wasn't just advocating for herself or her colleagues in the legislature. She was standing up for our fundamental rights as North Carolinians. Next, from Tomasi McDonald, Zion Person. On a late summer night, 9-year-old Zion Person was fatally shot in North Durham. He was one of five kids riding in a Ford Escape driven by his aunt, Danielle Ragland, who was taking the kids for snow cones. They all had little chores they'd done over the weekend, and she had promised she would take them out, Zion's grandmother, Sandra Person, told the Indy. They said they wanted to go to Pelicans. It was a Sunday, August 18th. Zion's mother, Ashley Ragland, was going to take him and his siblings back to school shopping the next day. Zion was going to start the fourth grade a week later. Sandra Person says that as the Escape approached the intersection of Duke and Leon Street, a burgundy Honda Accord rolled up beside them. Someone inside fired gunshots through a rear side window of the SUV. My granddaughter said, "They shooting," she says. "Y'all get down," Danielle Ragland yelled at the kids. In the barrage of gunfire, 15 to 22 bullets, Sandra Person says, Zion was struck in the back of the head, near his left ear, the bullet exiting through his forehead. His head slumped in his sister's lap. Zion's cousin, who was sitting in the rear of the SUV, told his aunt Zion was bleeding. Instead of waiting on an ambulance, she sped to the nearby Duke Hospital. His cousin, who had just turned 8, had been struck by a bullet that went through his forearm, but it wasn't life-threatening. Zion died just after 2 a.m. the next morning. The doctor said that if Zion would have made it, he would have been brain dead, Sandra Person says. The detective said Zion's spirit went through that car and protected everyone. Three young black men have been charged in connection with Zion's death. His death shocked the conscience of a city where the murder of young black men by other young black men is a common occurrence, serving as an avatar for all that has gone wrong amid Durham's growth and prosperity. The little boy with a big smile and bigger dreams was the collateral damage of an undeclared war among the hopeless and impoverished. As of early December, the city had seen 36 criminal homicides. According to the police, most of the victims and those charged with their deaths have been young black men. At a press conference after his death, Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry captured the sentiment of an entire city when she said, "Zion belongs to all of us." Zion wasn't fighting anyone's war. He was just a little boy with a mass of cute dreads that stopped just below his ears, starting quarterback for the Tri-City Panthers football team, which had just started practice and went undefeated without him this year. He scored high marks at his end of third grade tests. "He was a child that didn't need a whole lot," his grandmother says. "It didn't take much to make him happy. He loved everyone. He was a hugger." Thanksgiving was a difficult time for his grandmother, who remembered his happy presence at past family gatherings. He'd come through the door, say, "Hey, Grandma," give me a hug, and ask, "You got my ham? You got my greens, too? You put vinegar on it? You got my potato salad? You got my sweet potato pie?" The girls would be in the kitchen with me, so he'd tell me, "Grandma, when you finish, let me know so I can get the garbage." He would sit up under me. He was such a beautiful child. In the weeks after Zion was shot, Person says it was really, really hard for her. It's been even tougher for the children who were in the SUV with Zion the night he was killed. After he was shot, his 10-year-old cousin, who was in the front seat of the SUV, couldn't stop crying. For weeks she walked around with Zion's sneakers, Person says. The cousin who was shot, whom Sandra Person describes as an outgoing youngster, became withdrawn. All he wanted to do was sleep, she says. He stayed to himself, separated himself from everybody. He wouldn't eat, not even his favorite food. His sister saw her brother dying in front of her face, Person adds. She became really angry, snappy, and mad because her brother was gone. The children, along with their aunt, are all undergoing counseling, while Zion's mother is also seeking therapy. Person holds on by looking after her family, especially her octogenarian mother, and by literally holding on to her grandson's memories. She still has a video on her phone of Zion and her other grandkids tickling her feet, and his daily text messages to her that all begin with, "Good morning, Grandma." "He was such a sweet child," she says, "so lovable and helpful." Person says she's angry about the rash of gun violence in Durham. Last year, Zion's godfather was abducted and presumably killed over 2 kilos of stolen cocaine. Police believe his body, which has never been recovered, was fed to hogs, according to search warrants. We got lives being taken for no reason at all, person says. There are plenty of other people out here whose lives are hurting. I'm just sitting here talking about it, and it hurts down to my soul. Another one by Thomas E. MacDonald, Pierce Freelon. With his father's passing, the opening of North Star Church of the Arts, and a bid for state senate, Freelon has become the public face of one of Durham's most public families. This year has taught Pierce Freelon to put his faith not in mere things, but in eternal things. It also made the acclaimed musician, professor, community organizer, and now budding politician his storied family's public face after his father, the legendary architect Phil Freelon, passed away in July. Phil Freelon designed many of the nation's high-profile museums honoring the black tradition, including the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, and the Harvey B. Gantt Center for African American Arts and Culture in Charlotte. Pierce's mother, meanwhile, is the renowned Grammy-nominated jazz vocalist Nina Freelon. Those are big shoes to fill, and as Pierce Freelon acknowledges, it's a big charge to keep. The charge that I have inherited is really an instructional manual, Freelon says, and there's lots of things in there. Lift as you climb, that's one instruction. Never forget where you came from. Keep an attitude of gratitude. I'm always aware of my blessings. Bloom where you are planted. Some of the things in the manual came from my parents and some from my grandparents. If you plant a seed in the community, don't just leave it. Nurture the soil. Leave something for future generations. Fruit. Lay the foundation so your people can eat. Earlier this year, Freeman told Indy that caring for his father before his death at age 66 after a 3-year battle with ALS inspired him to run for the state senate. He says he promised Phil that he would fight to ensure that all residents have access to health care. His bid for the seat, left vacant by longtime Senator Floyd McKissick, marks Freeland's second foray into politics, following a respectable but unsuccessful bid for Durham mayor in 2017. He now has the endorsement of the mayor who defeated him, Steve Shule. A central plank in his campaign is the expansion of Medicaid, which the General Assembly has refused to do. He also wants to decriminalize marijuana and build the state's investments in renewable energy. To date, the tall, lithe, dreadlocked, and eminently likable Freelon has put his energy into building Durham's community. After making his name as the MC for the hip-hop and jazz ensemble The Beast, Freelon started a number of organizations that aim to address social justice issues through arts activism. Black Space in downtown Durham, which supports youth arts. A hip-hop and spoken word after-school program that has partnered with the city schools and Crime Prevention Council, and Beat Making Lab, a program that has traveled the globe. He's also the artistic director at the Red Brick Gothic Church that his parents transformed into an arts and culture space in February. At the corner of North and West Gear Streets, North Star Church of the Arts is the Elder Freelon's legacy project, a building they bought in 2017 and designed as a place where the arts could be elevated as a sacred practice, where creativity could deepen relationships. It's a safe space for those who have been marginalized because of race, economic status, or gender identity, and it venerates the city's patron saints, who are now with the ancestors, the dance titan Baba Chuck Davis, the brilliant writer and attorney Pauli Murray, who was the first black woman ordained as an Episcopalian priest, and the public schools integration pioneer Ann Atwater. North Star's website poses a compelling question in a community where artists often don't make a living wage, despite their considerable contributions to the city's life. What if church was a place where artists were praised and poets were prophets? Since it opened, North Star has hosted more than 100 events that highlight the arts, but also serve as a sanctuary for local activism. It's been quite a lot, Freeland says. The highlights for me have been an emergent strategy training for the city's activists. Even before North Star opened, it was a sanctuary for the Durham activists who tore down the city's Confederate monument in 2017. Another highlight for Freeland was the Gospel According to Baba Chuck service, which was held on July 21 to honor a man he calls his mentor. Triangle puppeteer extraordinaire Gigetto built a giant puppet bearing Davis's likeness. Days before the event, Freeland saw Gigetto's finished work and exclaimed, "Yo, man, this is going to be incredible. A puppet of Baba Chuck." Gigetto was like, "No, man, this is an avatar for Baba Chuck's spirit to join us." On the day of the service, Freeland listened intently as the North Star celebrants read quotes from Davis. Then the drums started, the dancers started praises, and the puppet came alive, Freeland recalls. There were children underneath, manipulating his hands, body, and shoulders, and I broke down in tears. It was one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had. I felt his presence, and it was a really deep experience for me. It was in the weeks after my dad had passed, and I understood that the veil between this world and the next is thin. I have the most beautiful, wonderful, and detailed script, and I'm lifting while I'm climbing, Freeland continues. I'm leading with love, especially for those who are not as fortunate as I have been. I am a child of the city of Durham. Another from Tomasi MacDonald, Satana DeBerry. While campaigning last year to become Durham County's district attorney, the reform-minded defense lawyer Satana DeBerry promised to overhaul the way the criminal justice system operates by addressing mass incarceration, jail overcrowding, and racial disparities. In late July, DeBerry released a six-month report touting her office successes, noting nearly 20 policies designed to limit county residents' involvement with the justice system, freeing it up to focus on serious crimes that harm community members. The Ivy Leaguer and Duke Law graduate remains adamant about not using the jail to warehouse low-level offenders, the homeless, and those who are struggling with substance abuse or are unable to post bond. Keeping people out of prison who don't belong there, prosecuting violent crime, and using our limited resources to address poverty, substance abuse, and helping to make Durham a safe place to live for all of us are at the heart of my policies, DeBerry says. She came to office amid a surge of reformist DAs across the country, including Rachel Rollins in Boston, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, the latter of whom DeBerry held up as a model, who argued that a system born from reactionary, zero-tolerance, tough-on-crime policies was intrinsically racist and counterproductive, producing a carceral state that had ripped apart communities of color. Of course, these efforts haven't come without resistance. In Philly, for example, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, a Donald Trump appointee, has attacked Krasner for fostering lawlessness and a new culture of disrespect for law enforcement. Shortly after taking office in January, DeBerry revamped a pretrial release policy that has led to fewer residents spending time in jail before their trial. That measure resulted in a 12% decline in the county jail population. Her office also resolved 22 homicide cases, an increase from the same period in 2018. She attends monthly meetings with Durham Police to review the results of sexual assault evidence kits, in an effort to bring closure to cases, many of which have gone unresolved for years. Her office waived unpaid traffic fines and fees for more than 2,000 residents who lost their licenses at least 2 years ago, enabling them to once again become legal drivers. She refused to accept court referrals for school-based incidents, with rare exceptions for serious crimes, and she stopped threatening criminal charges against parents of students who miss school. DeBerry says that since late July, her office has focused on providing more resources for crime victims, particularly victims of domestic abuse, sexual abuse, and human trafficking. There the most vulnerable people in our community, and oftentimes we forget about them, DeBerry says. We know that research has shown that when you get a decline in gun violence, you still have homicides, and those victims tend to be the past victims of domestic violence. Victims of domestic violence are not random, and they have suffered before they have been killed. Domestic violence victims often grow up in homes where family violence is pervasive. They have witnessed violence in their own homes. Well over 90% of Durham's homicide victims this year have been black men, often allegedly killed by other black men. Still, DeBerry is concerned with the perception that black men are violent. There are plenty of young and black men who contribute to our community, who care about people in our community, and who are in the struggle to make our community better, she says. All too often, stereotypes dictate how we talk to them and how we deal with them. Oftentimes, they are victims themselves, but they are reluctant to come forward because they are perceived as hyper-masculine and hyper-violent, and I just don't believe that about black men. DeBerry says that, though the decline in the county's jail population has held pretty steady since her office's reform, the numbers are up a little bit. But that's because there have been some more folks charged with violent crimes. Indeed, Durham saw a rash of high-profile shootings this summer and fall, with at least 36 through the week of December 7th, according to Durham Police Department. That number is higher than the total for all of last year, and nearly double that from 2017. In one 48-hour period in late October, two people were killed, eight others wounded in a series of shootings at four locations, an outbreak of violence that has become a flashpoint of the city's November elections, with critics deriding the city council's decision not to fund the additional officers Police Chief C.J. Davis had requested. Those incumbents won re-election. Next year, DeBerry says she'll press ahead, prioritizing prosecutions that keep people safe rather than putting small-time offenders behind bars, emphasizing victims' rights and implementing reforms that stem from the Raise the Age law, which took effect December 1 and made North Carolina the last state in the United States not to automatically prosecute 16- and 17-year-olds as adults. We're looking at different ways we can protect children in Durham County, DeBerry says. We want to focus on getting kids what they need instead of locking them up. Next, an article about Bob Phillips, Common Cause Executive Director, written by Jeffrey Billman. It would take a flow chart to keep track of all of the gerrymandering lawsuits that have been filed in North Carolina over the last decade. Federal lawsuits, state lawsuits, racial gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, state Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, new maps, special elections, canceled special elections, new lawsuits, more new maps. It hasn't stopped. It's almost like you need to be a Ph.D., says Bob Phillips, executive director of Common Cause. For almost 20 years, Phillips has been on the front lines of the gerrymandering fight back when Democrats controlled the legislature and fiddled with the lines to their advantage, while Republicans screamed bloody murder, and now, while the reverse is happening. His organization was behind one of the state lawsuits and was connected to the other, filed in Wake County Superior Court that forced lawmakers to redraw districts this year. Heading into next year's election and, in 2021, the next round of redistricting, Phillips sees an opportunity. If nothing else, lawmakers are on notice that extreme racial or partisan gerrymandering is illegal. Depending on how things shake out, they might be even willing to talk about creating an independent redistricting board. And that's what he really wants. Phillips thought he was close to it in 2011 after the Republicans broke the Democrats' stranglehold on the General Assembly. For years, they'd been in the wilderness, victims of districts drawn to minimize their power. Many of them had called for reform, but the ruling Democrats weren't listening. With the Tea Party wave, the tables turned. Just like that, Democrats got religion. And just enough Republicans stuck to their guns that Phillips thought there was a chance at real reform. In 2011, the bipartisan HB 824, with David Lewis, a future gerrymanderer-in-chief, and Rick Glazier, now head of the NC Justice Center, among the lead sponsors, passed the House of Representatives, 88-27. Senate Leader Phil Berger sent it to the Rules Committee to die. Over the next two sessions, after the General Assembly crafted radically GOP-oriented districts and the lawsuits started coming, Phillips kept searching for a legislative solution. But the legislature wouldn't budge. Even when bills were introduced with bipartisan support, he says, they were consigned to committee and left there to languish. Phillips says he gave up in 2016 when, following a court order, lawmakers were redrawing the state's congressional lines. The light bulb moment came when Lewis, the same guy who had sponsored reform legislation 5 years earlier, declared, "I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I don't believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats." To Lewis, this was a hyperbolic way of signaling that Republicans were engaged in partisan, not racial gerrymandering. To Phillips, this meant there was no point in doing anything legislatively on this issue. Later that year, Common Cause filed a federal lawsuit challenging the now admittedly partisan gerrymanders as unconstitutional. This was a new idea, that to explicitly and egregiously draw congressional districts to disadvantage one's political opponents, a practice as old as parties themselves, was unconstitutional. The court had already ruled that doing so on the basis of race wasn't allowed, and especially in the South, race and party were so intertwined that the intent was often irrelevant to the end result. As Common Cause's case wound through the federal system, the Supreme Court voiced reluctance to decide what was and was not an acceptable level of partisan gerrymandering. Then, in 2018, Justice Anthony Kennedy retired. He was replaced by the right-wing Justice Brett Kavanaugh, just in time for Common Cause to make oral arguments. Even so, Phillips says, he was hopeful. He shouldn't have been. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled, in essence, that there was nothing it could do. "I was crushed," he said, "but you pick yourself up. There's more fight to be had." He went down to the legislative building right after the decision came down, where Lewis was telling reporters the court had vindicated him. Phillips told him he wasn't going away. He had another card to play. Last November, immediately after the elections, Common Cause sued in Superior Court. Democrats had won more votes, and while they'd broken the GOP's legislative supermajorities in 2018, they had not come... Excuse me, I'm going to stop this and find my place. Democrats had won more votes, and while they'd broken the GOP's legislative supermajorities in 2018, they had not come anywhere close to claiming a majority. Common Cause argued that this reflected an extreme partisan gerrymander that was prohibited by the state constitution. That case was heard weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, and it produced a bombshell. A woman named Stephanie Hoffler contacted Phillips, who put her in touch with Common Cause's lawyers. Her late father, Thomas Hoffler, had helped the Republicans draw a district in North Carolina and other states. She had his files and wanted to turn them over. They contained a trove of information. "We were blown away by what Hoffler was doing," Phillips says. "It was breathtaking." Not only did the file suggest the lawmakers had lied to a federal court in order to delay a special election, but they also provided clear evidence that the Trump administration's effort to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census was an attempt to aid Republicans in elections. The Superior Court struck down the legislative districts. Surprisingly, the General Assembly didn't try to appeal. It was unlikely to get a friendly ruling in the state Supreme Court, which Democrats control, but Phillips expected Republicans to try to run out the clock until it was too late to redraw districts yet again. In retrospect, he thinks this was canny. In a time crunch, the state Supreme Court might have taken the job upon itself. This way, Republicans could maintain some control. The districts they passed all but guaranteed that they'd keep the House and probably the Senate. At the court's urging, they also passed congressional districts likely to lead to an 8-5 GOP split, which the Superior Court grudgingly approved earlier this month as candidate filing was about to begin. For Phillips, what happens next is a question mark. If there's a big Republican year, there will be little incentive to change the rules. If there's a blue wave big enough to give the Democrats one chamber, maybe that's the best scenario for a compromise. But what if somehow there's a blue tsunami and the Democrats take complete control of Jones Street? Will the same people arguing for reform today sing a different tune tomorrow? If they cut and run, Phillips says, they would be paying a big price with the public, and we would be leading the parade. No matter what, he adds, I hope we're at a different place than we were 10 years ago. They have all supported this at one time or another. The trick is getting everyone on the same page at the same time. And Jeffrey Billman wrote this article, Carol Folt. Carol Folt came from Dartmouth to Chapel Hill amid UNC's academic scandal and almost immediately found herself thrust into a no-win scenario, navigating a poisonous political atmosphere increasingly dominated by right-wing goobers on the Board of Governors, who thought little of higher education and less of intellectuals. And then came Silent Sam. It's easy for those of us on the outside to say that Folt should have acted sooner, that right after Charlottesville in 2017, she should have had the monument ripped down and melted instead of wringing her hands and letting everything fester. And maybe she should have. Maybe as activists charge, her inaction was complicity. But such open defiance of her bosses and state authorities, not to mention the law, would have caused her job and perhaps any chance of leading a major university in the future. Moral stands like that come with consequences. Folt had no love for the stupid statue. Its presence was an embarrassment, and the furor surrounding it had to be the source of more than one tension headache. In August 2018, when demonstrators felled the statue, Folt dutifully called their action unlawful and dangerous, but you could tell that her heart wasn't in it. The monument has been divisive for years, she said, and its presence has been a source of frustration for many people, not only on our campus but throughout the community. In this context, divisive is public relations code for racist AF, by the way, and source of frustration means everyone wants this thing gone. Everyone, that is, except the Board of Governors. On their side was a 2015 state statute that required the monument to be placed right back where it was, or, if that was impossible, somewhere equally prominent. Folt did not want that to be McCorkle Place, Sam's former home. At first, she and UNCCH Board of Trustees pitched a $5 million History and Education Center to house Silent Sam in context, which went over like a lead balloon. Students called it a racist shrine. Confederacy lovers wanted Sam back in his former glory. The Board of Governors told Folt to shelve that plan and start over. Folt was over it. On January 14, Folt told the BOG she was resigning at the end of the semester. Then she immediately had Sam's base torn from the ground and thrown into storage. It would never again sit in McCorkle Place. She'd see to that. Enraged, the BOG told her to leave by the end of the month. Off she went to head the University of Southern California, which is now enmeshed in a college admissions scandal, with the Silent Sam matter presumably settled once and for all. But, of course, it wasn't. The day before Thanksgiving, the Board of Governors announced that it had reached an agreement with the North Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans to give the neo-Confederate nonprofit the Civil War Participation Trophy, as well as $2.5 million to build a home for it. The local media, including Indy, has covered this issue considerably in the last month, so there's no need to delve into the details. The highlights: the BOG settled a lawsuit before it existed, knowing full well the SCV had no case and didn't even have the standing to sue. Then the BOG hid from public scrutiny, refusing to even hold its meetings in person for fear of encountering pissed-off students and inquiring journalists. The fallout is only beginning. Last week, we learned that the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation pulled a $1.5 million donation to UNC over the SCV mess. And as UNC Law Professor Eric Mueller noted on Twitter, the university stands to lose black faculty and students as well. Everything about Silent Sam and the SCV deal has been a disaster, equal parts hilarious, pathetic, and infuriating, made possible by white supremacy so ingrained and internalized we barely recognize it when it's staring us in the face. Folt was a lot of things in this story: a flawed protagonist, a well-paid cog in a machine, Someone who moved here unaware she was sticking her head in a political wood chopper. She also tried to begin reconciling the university's troubled history with modernity. In 2015, for example, UNC Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees changed the name of Saunders Place to Carolina Hall. But state politics made further steps in that direction all but impossible. She'd either have to live with Silent Sam, or she'd have to leave. Ultimately, Folt left, and she took Sam with her. It was an imperfect solution for our story's imperfect hero, but it drove the Board of Governors, not to mention neo-Confederates and white supremacists, nuts. And that made it a beautiful thing to watch. Well, as we approach the end of the time we've allotted for us, I've read 9 out of 19 articles from the Indie Week, Notable People of 2019. Here are the ones that I did not read, and you may choose to go to IndieWeek.com and find them for yourself and read them. There are many interesting ones. Karnataka Zair Brown, a transgender inmate who was transferred out of an all-male prison. Javiera Caballero, Durham, first Latinx city council member elected. Crystal Dunn, soccer World Cup winner on the women's team. Of course, Ashley Christensen, the National Chef of the Year. Jeremy Tung, a Durham scientist who's studying health and social status. Suleiman and Leah Mousi, the Art of Cool Festival in Durham. Jay Clapp, the famous Durham drag queen. Emil Kang, founder of Carolina Performing Arts. And NC Poet Laureate Jackie Shelton Green. And Charles Phaneuf, director of the Raleigh Little Theater. Reading for our blind and printed parrot audience, John Fetterson has been reading excerpts from Indie Week from December 18th. After this initial broadcast, it will may be found on our website, ncreadingservice.org. The North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks you for listening, and stay tuned for more next week.